Jones, no relation, saying,
"Your failures and fears are portals. Step through."
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, where you can listen to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m. This is Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show. My interview this month is with Will of Fiddler's Fungus Farm. Will fills us in about his home animal sanctuary and, of course, about mushrooms, from cooking to growing, and even which ones are local. So tune in to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m., only on KBOO.
At last, it's finished.
What is it?
I call it the Intention Invention.
Oh, well, that sounds impressive. What does it do?
It's like a radar gun that measures a car's speed. But this one reveals the true intentions of whoever it's aimed at.
Fascinating.
Just watch.
I hope this guy thinks I'm a decent, good-natured person.
And that was a clip from the film The Intention Invention, directed by one of our guests today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about the Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, and Technology. This is a five-day event that'll be taking place at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry from August 6th through the 10th. And we have one of the co-directors of the festival with us today, Peter Alexander. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's always good to see you, and we're excited. The festival is going to be back soon at OMSI once again.
Yes, and we're also excited to be joined by two animation directors who will be appearing at the festival. Both of them work in traditional animation fields. Let's see, Jess McKay, he's a puppet artist, musician, filmmaker, and activist based in L.A. His puppet work includes projects with Disney, the Jim Henson Company, and Sesame Studios. Jess, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, SW and Peter. Nice to see you.
And RJ Sullivan is here. RJ is an award-winning animation filmmaker, composer, and screenwriter originally from Southern California. He now lives in Portland, where his studio, Catch and Hatch, produces hand-drawn 2D animation films for both adults and children. RJ, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Peter, this is the third annual Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, and Technology. You brought it to Portland a few years ago. The first two have been popular with both audiences and with artists. What's the focus for this year's festival?
Lots of animation, once again. We are screening about 175 projects and roughly 75% are animation. So a lot of animated works, all kinds, 2D, 3D, and we have lots of VR this year, as well as dome films. So we're going to be using the planetarium at OMSI for several really cool dome screenings.
Right. So you got lots of technology in there, and a lot of it is new and emerging. You and your co-director of the festival, Marissa Cohen, have been doing this for a while. And we'll mention that not all of the technology is digital. Much of the animation that you'll be screening is hand-drawn or done with stop motion or other traditional methods.
Right. We have a lot of stop motion this year, various styles. So there's all types of animation. So whatever kind of animation you like the best, it's more than likely at the festival this year. So we have sequences dedicated just to stop motion.
All right. Well, our two artists here both have films that are screening at the festival. Jess, let's start with you. Tell us about your film, Kindness Town.
Okay, so Kindness Town, it came out last year in 2024, and we're so happy to have it screening at the PF Cat Festival. It's a story of a group of puppets who learn what they're made out of and decide to change their materials due to ethical reasons. So it's based in reality. You know, I'm a puppeteer, I'm a puppet artist. I've worked with the Jim Henson Company, Sesame Studios, and I am also a vegan person. And when you become a vegan person, it sort of changes your worldview about a lot of different things. And then suddenly I'm working in the puppetry world and I notice Big Bird, this character we all know and love. And as a puppet builder and as a person who's worked closely with these puppets, I know for a fact these are real feathers that are on this puppet. So I started digging, doing some research. Due to publicly available information, it's been estimated that over 7,000 birds have been killed over the years just to decorate this one puppet. So the question is, like, why am I criticizing Sesame Street? There's a McDonald's. There's a million other people who use animals in different ways and in ways that I feel are unjust. A couple of reasons. Number one, it's my industry. It's my backyard. You know, I'm a puppeteer, so it's like, let's keep our own house clean before we start looking at other people's homes. And I think Sesame Street is a unique case because they do position themselves as moral leaders for children. They always talk about kindness, and it seems like one of the big moral questions of our age is our use of animals and how we're using animals. And that is something that Sesame Street has not really addressed in any meaningful or substantive way. So I made Kindness Town to sort of talk about this. And what I realized is there's a lot of discourse in the world today about, you know, you'll hear the right in America, the MAGA people, and they'll say, well, Sesame Street is leftist propaganda. And as someone who's actually making leftist propaganda for children, that's offensive to me because Sesame Street is not that. They're a very centrist, neoliberal corporate program, and that is just what they are. So I did see a gap in this. You know, there's parents out there who want to show this type of content to their kids. So we're actually creating a full season now based on our pilot episode that's going to be showing in Portland pretty soon.
Yes, well, we mentioned that you've worked with the Jim Henson Company, and you were working with them. You were working on puppets, fabricating and creating puppets when you had some moral qualms, and you brought those to Brian Henson.
I did. My primary job at the Henson Company was I was a puppeteer for a show called Puppet Up. I did do some refurbishments for these puppets, but mostly I was a puppeteer for the company. So I had this quandary, I had this moral question. I'm like, can I continue to participate in this thing that I see is not great? It's something that I see as an injustice. So I tried to change the industry from within, sort of, you know, you talk to people backstage, you talk to people behind the scenes. And at a certain point, I was like, I just need to talk to Brian about this. So I sent him an email and I said, hey, I'm not really comfortable using these materials. I don't think I can continue, but I've been developing these alternative feather materials that we can hopefully incorporate, and let's move forward in a great way together. This is a great opportunity. Without getting into too much detail, I ended up reaching out to Brian several times, and he not once ever responded to me, which is, you know, that's frustrating. You know, you do things what you think is the right way. You approach somebody politely and kindly. This is a person I'd worked with for years. And then for him to give me the cold shoulder after that was, It was distressing. Eventually what I ended up doing is I started a whole campaign. We ended up protesting outside of the gates of Henson Studios here in Los Angeles. And we've tried many, many, many different methods to get them to change. They haven't changed. And I sort of, at a certain point last year, a Washington Post article came out about Sesame Street, and it outlined that Sesame Street has really lost a lot of the cultural clout that they used to have. The Nielsen ratings had them in 14th place in their age group. And it's like, for a show that's spending, close to $100 million to produce it every year, to be 14th place. So I realized they may have, for my generation, I'm a millennial, they may have meant something that's huge, but for kids today, they don't mean what they used to. And so I saw it not really worth my effort to try to get them to change anymore. And that's why I'm kind of building my own thing with Kindness Town. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kindness Town, this is a pilot of sorts. You're hoping to spin this out into a series. And it sounds kind of meta. These characters, they're puppets, they're interacting with an audience, and they're looking at what they're made of. So tell us about your plans for taking this forward.
So we're deep in development right now on our first season. We're going to be releasing 5 new episodes in 2026. It's a musical, so a lot of the music is written. I'm co-writing with my co-writing partner for the music is named Sweet Goose. He's based in the UK and he does wonderful music. Everybody look up Sweet Goose. He's a really, really wonderful songwriter. So our plan is we're going to be releasing 5 new episodes, and it still does have a vegan theme, but we've expanded our scope and it's become a very subversive anti-capitalist show for 3-year-olds. Like, we're dealing with what it means to be a landlord. We're dealing with healthcare insurance. We're dealing with media literacy, borders, and land rights. And in one episode, our puppets unionize and seize the means of production. So we're going there. Yeah.
So we mentioned that you've worked with Disney, the Jim Henson Company, Sesame Studios. You're now leading your own teams with the Jess McKay Company. What's your approach to being a leader, a mentor? When it comes to decision making, you're the guy.
Well, for the decision making aspect of it, I think having a vision is helpful and important. If you have a very clear idea in your head of what you want this thing to be, it's impossible to do it, to lead a team, if you don't have a clear idea of what it's supposed to be. Whenever I have led a team in the past, I try to make sure that anything I'm asking anybody else to do, I am willing and able to do myself, but also being humble enough to know that I don't possess every skill. So for example, I'm working with some art department people for this next round, because my art department's okay, but if you watch our pilot, you'll see some houses in the background that were constructed that just, you can see the frustration in them. But making puppets on the video here, that's my specialty. But in terms of leading teams, I think empathy is really important. For example, I've worked on puppet projects where I'm there for a week and a half and all I get to do is like wiggle a hand. And then so at the end of it, I feel a sense of pride, but also like, ugh. So any puppeteer that I'm asking to come on set is going to be able to puppeteer a character that they're going to be able to point at, hopefully in the cut, and be like, that was me, that I did that. So yeah, giving people a sense of ownership and making sure they feel proud of what they're doing, I think is really helpful.
Well, you work in one of the oldest theatrical art forms there are, puppetry. This is an art that goes back well before animation or film came on the scene, but it's had a huge influence on both.
I think so. Yeah, puppetry is a wonderful tradition. As long as, we hear about the shadows on the cave of Plato, like that's puppetry right there. And people had, anytime you are taking an object and anthropomorphizing it, giving it life in any way, as you know from animators, the most simple way, even children, if they're playing with two toys, that's sort of puppetry. It's imaginative play, breathing life into characters. Puppetry also has a rich and deep tradition of protest and of being subversive. Puppets are often allowed to get away with saying things that if a real human said it, we wouldn't stand for that. And it's very similar to animation in that sense. You look at a character like Cartman from South Park, it's like, well, if that was a human, I don't think that would fly. But it's not just about saying like provocative things, but it is a tool that can allow people to kind of get outside of themselves a little bit and reframe and look at things differently than if it was a human. We have all sorts of hangups around humans.
Yeah, I remember from the 80s and 90s in a lot of really great marches and political actions, the Bread and Puppet Theater would show up, and these were, wow, like 8, 10, 12 foot puppets manipulated by three or four people.
Yeah. You know, you look at the blimp that they have of Donald Trump where he just looks like a buffoon. That's, you know, blimps were invented by a puppeteer for that parade, the Macy's parade. So yeah, it's these objects can be so powerful and they can evoke such emotion. And puppets have a bad reputation. They have a reputation of being for kids, it being a children's art form. And everybody here is into animation. You know, it's the same sort of thing. We're fighting against that sometimes. And I do want to thank Peter and Marissa and all of the people over at the Portland Festival for including Kindness Town, because I would imagine it's a very difficult piece to program. The kids festivals didn't want us because we're a little bit too provocative for that. We don't exactly fit in with, you know, narrative short adult film festivals because it's meant for 3-year-olds. So it's like a really special thing that you all selected our film. So thank you.
Well, we're happy to have you. It's really well done. It's very polished. It's the minutes zip by. It's just well done.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Yeah. You know, and we had a very small, relatively small budget. We produced it for well under $10,000, which for a 14-minute long puppet musical is like, I don't even know how we did. Like, I worked for free, you know, essentially. Yeah. If I counted up all the work that I did on this thing, building all the puppets and writing all the music, this is like, you know, way, way more expensive. I used to envision myself as someone who's given jobs, like, oh, I need to find a job. But then I realized, like from my Henson experience, like if I'm waiting for someone else to give me an opportunity, I have to play by their rules. But if I want to make a new system, I just do it myself, you know? And anybody out there listening who has even a shred of a spark of an idea, I would just recommend, you know, start making it. Your first couple things you make are not going to be great. And hopefully it'll get better as you go. And when you are making things, people interact with you differently. I wouldn't have gotten the deal to make my 5 episodes had I not made the first episode on my own. You show the world that you're the kind of person who makes stuff when you make stuff. So sometimes you just have to do it and don't wait for permission for somebody else to give you permission. You just do it first.
Well, on that note, let's play a clip from the film Kindness Town.
And every puppet loves hair with free flowing movement.
Oh, what's the hair made of?
The hair is made of bird feathers.
Oh, how do you get the feathers off the birds?
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today about the Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, and Technology. We're joined by one of the festival co-directors, Peter Alexander, as well as animation filmmakers R.J. Sullivan and Jess McKay. All right, R.J., over to you. We mentioned that you work in hand-drawn 2D animation. In these days of computer-generated imagery and artificial intelligence, that seems like a radical act.
Yeah, it's getting more radical by the moment. We're going to see a lot more AI-produced material flooding everything. But yeah, so I still draw by hand. And for the intention invention, I all the backgrounds are scribbled in by hand, too.
This is your film that'll be playing at the Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, Technology, the Intention Invention.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's just a darkly comic short. Yeah, hand-drawn. Basically, it takes the idea of an invention like a radar gun that can read human intentions or human feelings. The idea is that what we say is not necessarily how we feel. But it still starts off from kind of an idealistic perspective. The inventor who invents it has a great goal of letting all the misunderstood be understood. And then as he uses it and tests it with his friend, he starts obviously seeing intentions that are not positive or things that are, you know, there's a moral is you're better off not knowing probably. And I think that's also true, because the farther down the rabbit hole I got thinking about this concept, the more I really realized, like, if you were able to decipher all of that, you know, had all that information available, well, you'd probably be turned off by a lot of people, you know, but you would know too much, because we filter so many things through what we say before we say them. You know, that's necessary for society to function. It's like the lubricant, you know, because our thoughts just kind of come in our head, go away. And then if we spout it off of every single thing that we thought, we don't even necessarily think that thing 2 minutes later. So it kind of questions like a whole idea, you get way deep into it, about like morality and words. If you always knew exactly what somebody did, then could they make a choice? You know, it's weird. We don't have a choice to be good or bad. It's like that kind of transparency is just interesting, because I never really thought about it like that. If you knew everything that somebody was doing all the time, they wouldn't have a choice of what they could do.
A successful marriage would be measured probably within weeks instead of years.
Yeah. A lot of things, a lot of relationships would be affected. So for the technique, it was all hand-drawn, scribbled in. So every frame is scribbled in, which took a long, long time. But that was kind of, once I started doing it, I realized how good it looked. And I thought, you know, I just couldn't stop. I was like, I got to do it this way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing better than scratchy pen lines for overcoming the slickness of the sort of mass-produced animation.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one way to differentiate yourself, but also just add a look that, you know, I hadn't quite seen. You know, it's all, there's so many variables that go into any animation. That's why everybody's style is so different. And it's great when you see all those choices come together in a way that's surprising to you. You know, you're like, oh, I didn't realize it was going to look like that. But if you're happy, that's a good thing.
Well, the story behind the intention invention, this definitely sounds like the sci-fi cautionary fable track for, you know, what could be in our future if we're not careful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we already see that with all of our data being tracked. Since we live online so much, you know, that's essentially like you see somebody's intention in their history of where they go online, and all this data that's tracked is like, you know, we may not be able to access it, but companies buy and sell it. So, you know, it's a good thing that everybody can't see it at this point. It's not a good thing that the companies can sell it. You know, in the past without the technology, that wasn't the case. You know, you go down to the store, nobody knows you walk down to the store to buy like a gallon of milk. But if you're tracked because you have a phone with you, I mean, everything, there's way more that's known. So yeah, so we're on that trajectory. If we had implants or something in our arms, you know, that.
I'm hoping that, you know, people aren't looking at dystopian sci-fi as a, you know, a how-to manual. Let's hope it doesn't get there, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Listeners might have seen your work, RJ, in your animated pilot for the Pinto Variety Hour, featuring Pinto the Mean Bean. That was another one of your adult-oriented animations.
Yeah, that last year that had its premiere at Portland Festival of Cinema Animation Technology, and then it went on and toured the world, and it's still in festivals now. But yeah, that was an adult comedy pilot starring a bean that hosted a surreal variety show. That was fun, and I'm just trying to get that onto a streaming service now.
Well, that's been a darling of the festival circuit, and another one of your shorts has been really popular. That's called Arlo Sings the Blues in the Middle of the Night, featuring anybody who's owned a cat will appreciate the sensibility of this short film. That's a film, though, that's geared more towards kids. What's the trick to switching sensibilities between adult animation and kids animation? Do you have focus groups of friends or the children of friends?
You know, it's funny because I think of Arlo Sings the Blues and Pinto the Mean Bean, the children's short, as for adults as much as kids. I mean, I was thinking about adults and some of the ideas. The sense of humor could be for adults, you know, it's just a little tamer. I don't know, I guess I kind of come from the same mentality. I think that when you do children's shorts, it feels like you can really get to the heart of the matter quicker, because adults see things that are simple as cliche often, or they want it to be more complex. They want to go on a detective search, you know, which is good. That's what makes a lot of art fascinating, is that you want to figure it out, you know. But with children's things, they don't need to have all these little crumbs to finally get to the thing. You kind of got to bring it a little sooner. But it doesn't mean it's not important, and it's not things that adults also should hear.
Yeah, I can see Jess nodding in agreement.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Kids, such a powerful medium to reach the adults, too. Oftentimes, the parents are going to be watching alongside the kids. And, yeah, there are little nods in there. It's such a wonderful thing when you're watching something made for kids, and then you're like, oh, that wasn't for them. That was for me.
Yeah, so, that's kind of my favorite aspect of it, is when parents see them, and they go, you know, that's really good for kids. You know?
Yeah.
And then you're like, that's actually good for you too, you know. Or a lot of those messages, if you want your kids to know that message, something that you also should be reminded of, you don't outgrow those kind of things.
But. Yeah, I took improv classes for a very long time, and by the time you get to the most advanced classes, they're just telling you the same exact things you learned in the very first class. And it's like that with creating content for kids. Like, the adults need, you know, sharing is caring. That's an important one.
Yeah, right. That's a big one, yeah.
We mentioned artificial intelligence earlier. And, you know, some people see AI as a threat. Storyboard artist jobs are almost extinct now. The interesting thing is that there have been these court rulings that AI cannot be copyrighted. So looking in your crystal ball, what do you see about the future? Is there going to be a swing back towards traditional animation among younger people these days?
I think absolutely. I think there's going to have to be some kind of reckoning at some point where it becomes, you know, because when it becomes so saturated with AI specifically for images and video and animation, people already have that fatigue, you know, just from social media and just too much content that people get overloaded and then get cynical and get, you know, I've seen that when they only see 2 seconds of something, you know, and that is not seen like an artwork, you know, like what Jess is doing, an episode, that the artwork is the episode, the artwork isn't 20 seconds of that. And same thing with the film, a feature film, that artifact is the entire feature film. So I think that with the scrolling now and with the just with what AI is going to do and is doing, is just the proliferation of media. People are just thinking they know things before they actually do because they see snippets of it. And so yeah, I think there will be a pullback from that, and there will be like a kind of people taking a pause, people kind of considering it and trying to make meaning out of it for themselves, whether they like something or want to pursue it. So I think with the way we consume media, yeah. There will be some kind of pullback, and maybe traditional forms will gain a little bit more power. But that just comes down to like marketplace stuff, you know. If it's going to have a really big platform for hand-drawn animation again, that would just be because people demanded it or something, you know. I don't know if that would be the case.
All right. Well, Peter, the Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, and Technology is happening for 5 days in August, the 6th through the 10th. That's 5 days of screenings, panels, presentations, parties, and an award ceremony. Can you give us a quick rundown of some of the highlights?
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, we have a variety of panels this year. We have The Art of Acting in Animation, Ads, and Games, which is being sponsored by SAG-AFTRA. We have a Stop Motion and the Path to Television panel, which has a lot of stop motion industry heavyweights from shows like In the Know and Severance, Tiny Chef. So, and then we have a lot of great screenings. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't even know where to begin. We have a couple of feature films, The Storm from China. It's almost like a Studio Ghibli style, very, very well done animated feature. Magic Beach, which is from Australia. That's a collaboration. There's several directors involved in that, and they each do their own little segment, and it's really fun to watch. It's great for kids. So yeah, lots of features. We have a high level of world and U.S. and regional premieres once again this year. So there's a lot of projects that are going to be seen at PIFCAT for the first time anywhere, or certainly for the first time in the States. Yeah, I cannot do this chat with you without mentioning that we have Zombified this year, which is our animated shorts involving zombies. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And it's not, you know, really, really scary zombie stuff for the most part. I don't know that I'd bring a little kid to it, but certainly I think, you know, teen and up, it's fine. And thanks, by the way, for the kind words, RJ, about the festival. I mean, you know, we're highly biased at PIFCAT, but we think it's a pretty good festival. And we think people have a good time. And the filmmaker feedback over the years has been excellent. And yeah, we're hoping once again to have thousands of people turn out like the first 2 years.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we've been talking today about the Portland Festival of Cinema, Animation, and Technology. Our guests have been one of the festival co-directors, Peter Alexander, as well as animation filmmakers RJ Sullivan and Jess McKay. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. And thanks to the filmmakers for being with us and for all the participating filmmakers this year, because that's the fuel. That's what makes it all happen.
Yes, RJ and Jess, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter, for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about the festival, where would they look?
They could look at our website, which is pdxfestofcinema.com. And you can also find tickets on OMSI's website.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.